Welcome back, everybody, to another fun edition of the Rolex Whiskey Passion Project. Loving seeing all your ratings, all your listening. Traffic keeps going up. Hey, we're just going to keep having fun here. I'm super fortunate to be able to talk to people that are even more passionate than I am about whiskey. And today's gentleman just published a pretty sick book. So I'm pretty excited. With no further ado, Aaron Goldfrog, welcome to the show, sir. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
It's kind of a perfect timing. Got the book, got the watch, you know, heard a lot of great things. I'm like, I got to talk to you. So this all worked out. Aaron, first, you want to, first of all, introduce yourself to the listeners, if you don't mind.
Yeah, my name's Aaron Goldfarb. As you said, I am a longtime journalist, often writing about things you drink, whether craft beer, whiskey, cocktails, whatever. I've written 12 books, six of them on booze, and my newest one is Dusty Booze, as you said.
I love it. Aaron, give me your first memory of whiskey in your life. And it's generally not a good experience, but that's okay. But maybe yours is different.
It wasn't necessarily a bad experience. I didn't really start drinking till college, which would have been in the late 90s, kind of right before the bourbon renaissance. So, and I was going to school in upstate New York at Syracuse. So that's almost Canada up there. So what was on the shelves and at the bars were a lot of Canadian whiskey, which was still pretty hot at the time.
I'm going to stop you for 1 second to quantify.
Yeah.
A lot of Canadian whiskey, because in the late 90s, I was still running nightclubs, and there wasn't a lot. Like, how many, like, up there, was it 15 whiskeys, or were there four?
It was probably four.
Because like, that was, like, the vodka boom. That was the Like, you know, that was rum, like, random rum. Even gin. Like, gin was, like, the sophisticated drinkers. I don't know if that was up there by Syracuse, but, like, down here, it was, like, oh, I'm having a gin. Like, cool, bro. Have another.
No, yeah. I mean, that's for sure. I mean, Hendrix gin hit the scene in 1999, which I wrote about in my previous book, Brand Mysticism. And I remember starting to see the weird, you know, squat bottle around college campuses and going, what the hell is this thing? And who the fuck's drinking gin? So when I say there was a lot of Canadian whiskey, I don't mean a lot of skews. I mean, just a lot of bottles of Crown Royal and other Canadian whiskeys for people to drink or make seven and sevens with, et cetera.
And also, I don't know if it was the same over there, but like whiskey was like a shot. I didn't even know that Jameson actually made good whiskey until like maybe 5-6 years ago. I was like, hey, like that's the stuff that my guys behind the bar are like pounding it because they're not doing like Rumpelmintz or Jägermeister anymore.
Yeah, I'm like, okay. Absolutely right. Yeah, there were no Glencairns at Syracuse, to say the least. We were taking it back quickly. We crossed the border to get some duty-free Crown Royal for a little cheaper. We thought that was sophisticated. Of course, it comes with a purple sack. Which
the bag. The bag.
It's the height of classiness to a 21-year-old trying to impress
that was,
some sorority girls.
I said to someone the other day, that was like the first Merce. Like, we didn't even know.
Yeah,
back then with the bag. I mean,
yeah,
you know, use it to keep all the bottles shipped, you know, behind the bar. In like they would, you know, they guys would roll in super confident with like their cocktail kits in the Crown Royal bag.
Yeah, throw your golf tees in there if you were a golfer.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of uses for the sack.
Oh my god, hilarious. Okay, so that was that pretty normal. What's the experience like for the first time you like had whiskey that kind of piqued your mind? And you're like, shit, this is good.
Huh, that's a good question. Jeez, I thought Crown Royal was pretty good compared to a lot of stuff. But the serious answer is when I moved to Manhattan, now we're talking maybe circa 2003 or 2004, my friend tells me this guy who apparently makes whiskey is going to be at the liquor store this afternoon. We should go see him and see what he's doing. That ended up being Fred Noe, who was shilling Baker's back then. I'd never had Baker's. It was $40 a bottle, which was a freaking fortune to me. But I listened to Fred tell his stories he's been telling for the last 30 years, probably. Bought, you know, sucked it up and bought that bottle of Baker's, and he autographed it. And I nursed that thing for as many weeks as I possibly could because I knew this was at a much higher caliber than even that Crown Royal in the purple sack.
Well, and you're talking about 2003, so
Yeah.
In Manhattan, single malts are starting to creep on the scene. Yet the liquor stores are like, that's a great story. We'll go American whiskey, please. And Booker's will be here and Fred will be telling his story that he's just so excited to get out of Bardstown and go talk to people.
Yeah, color of Kentucky, man. You're right. Yeah, I mean, most people still going back to it were drinking flavored vodkas. This was the era of teeny culture, T-I-N-I, you know, everything, yeah. Everything a martini, even if it has nothing to do with what we would call a martini today. And banking people, of which a lot of my friends were, getting into single malt. So I got to try a lot of early single malt on their dime. Johnny Walker Blue was still huge back then. I remember.
I mean, weddings, bar mitzvahs, like that's Johnny Walker Blue, top shelf.
I remember a friend of mine got a bottle of Johnny Walker Blue when we were about 25. And I'll never forget, it was, I don't know how much you're into college basketball, it was that famous, I think it was a Sweet 16 game where Illinois came back from like 25 points to beat Arizona. And we killed a bottle of Johnny Walker Blue in front of the screen. It was a real memorable night of drinking, which for the time seemed astronomically expensive.
Which you jumped from $40 Booker to probably back then $130 Johnny Walker Blue?
Yeah, insane. Absolutely insane. I didn't pay for it, thankfully, back then. That would have been like a day's pay for me at that time. I certainly drank my share.
I tell you, you know, I remember like in my restaurants, we'd have these buyouts.
Yeah.
And like literally, we'd be like, no top shelf booze. And there was only one thing, Johnny Walker Blue on the top shelf. And if you didn't put that stipulation in, the first guy that walked in, open bar, I'll have Johnny Walker Blue. And you're like, and you can get the F out right now.
So yeah.
I know what you're trying to do, buddy. But, you know, once again, I felt like blended whiskeys, I don't know if this is the same for you. It's like, they all tasted kind of the same.
Yeah.
Except a little bit better. So, like, you know, a Johnny Walker Blue versus a Johnny Walker Black, when the guys had three teenies, he's not going to know the difference.
Yeah, as you got up the color scale in Johnny Walker, it just became slightly less painful to drink and slightly more pleasurable and a little more ostentatious in packaging. But, you know, there's still men of a certain age that consider Johnny Walker Blue like the epitome of class and, you know, balling out.
Yeah, but we're kind of like, you know, our little core, we're kind of like unicorns, because to 99% of the world, that is top of the chain. That's the best of the best. Johnny Walker Blue is like, I'm going to like celebrate life, something. I'm busting out Johnny Walker Blue. You and I walking in, and you're like, Jesus, people still drink Coke? You know, when we see that, like
yeah. Cool. Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely a blast from the past. Not something I find myself drinking a lot, but the once every 5 years, somehow Blue ends up in my glass.
Last year or the year before at the Nth in Vegas, the boys from Diageo, Ewan did a deconstruct of Johnny Walker Blue, one of the ghosts and rares. And that really got me so much appreciation. I'm like, holy shit. Like, this
those
is like
quite good.
A lot goes into this bottle. There's not just like, not like I imagined, like, you know, putting it in food terms. Go to the farmer's market, buy a bunch of vegetables, make a soup. Hey, vegetable soup. You know, this was like, holy shit, you got to get your balances right. And like, that was the first time I like looked up and I'm like, dude, Johnny Walker Blue, like, that's not just something you know, throw in the microwave for 30 seconds and it's ready to go. There's a lot of action that happens to make a bottle of Johnny Walker Blue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why they say blending is a great art.
I I'm kind of bummed, but I'm excited for John Glazer's next trip, because I felt like he was like Iron Chef whiskey with Compass Box.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I'm going to take a little bit of this, a little bit of that, fully transparent, and boom, this is what you got. And I'm like, whoa, dude, that's cool. But he comes from the Johnny Walker Blue pedigree. So it's not, you know, it's like, hey, I'm just going to step up my ingredients without any rules and regulations, within reason.
Yeah, I mean, I was drinking their extinct blend series last night, and one of them, I forget the name, is meant to mimic a 1980s Johnny Walker Blue blend, and it was absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited whatever his next chapter is, because when it comes to Scotch whiskey blending, been fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with John, like, his brain is just firing at a whole nother level.
Absolutely.
Now, okay, so now we've gotten through we're in the Walkers, we're moving forward. another scotch that comes to mind that you like? Because like mine personally, it was like a Glendronic and then a Yamazaki sherry cask that really just opened my mind to like what scotch whiskey could be. And it wasn't just something I poured over ice like I'd done my entire life.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably by this era, I'm kind of shifting to bourbon, but I was also getting into the Islay malts. I think a lot of young men, you know, they see it as kind of some machismo, how much, you know, peat they can handle. And every man has a point in his life where he's just drinking, you know, absolute peat and smoke bombs and loving every minute of it. That was definitely my late 20s. Lefroy, Lagavulin, Ardbeg, et cetera.
Oban.
Yeah.
It's so funny because I grew up drinking Johnny Walker Black.
Yeah.
I grew up drinking J&B, you know, all with a good bit of peat action to it. Yeah. Anytime I tried the lagers or the Obans, I was like, that's not my jam. And I didn't find bourbon, you know, because I'm born in South Africa. I didn't find bourbon until 2015-ish.
Oh, wow.
And ironically, you know, that's when I kind of started investing in whiskey.
Yeah.
But ironically, my first bourbon was really a Michter's 20, 2015, because I had one. And I bought it from New York for $994, shipped to San Diego. And I put it in my, like, Pride and Joy collection, and the wax tab started opening. And, you know, obviously the bottle wasn't replaceable. And there was a gentleman in L.A., and he's like, hey, I got a 2016. I'll drive down to San Diego. We'll meet in a Whole Foods parking lot. I'll give you my 16. I'll open your 15, pour you 2 ounces, and head back to L.A. And I came home, and I drank. I'm like, holy shit, American whiskey's good. I mean, it was like a dessert compared to scotch.
Yes.
You know, it was like, this is like booze ice cream. There's caramels and toffees and like, I can see how this is like you really enjoy it, as opposed to scotch where you had to like still make that face every time you drank it. Like, that's alcohol. That M20 was like my, you know, obviously not all like that, but that was my introduction. So I never really knew anything about it. And then obviously, you know, really pushed hard and fast to kind of like, I want to try as much of this as I possibly can.
Yeah.
Go back to your journey now.
I was very lucky to move to New York in the early aughts when a lot of different alcohols are kind of having a renaissance. New York is the cocktail renaissance capital of the world. All these cocktail bars are popping up and revisiting classics. Craft beer was a little slow in New York, but it was coming. And, you know, the bourbon renaissance was really happening in the aughts. And there were lots of people with money in New York willing to invest in it and share bottles. And of course, I mean, getting up to probably 2008, you could still, you know, get Pappy on the shelf for $80 or whatnot, which was a lot of money back then, but obviously
a lot of money.
Right.
I remember being offered it at my restaurants. I'm like, eh, the cogs on that's just too high.
Yeah. Yeah. It was an incredible time for drinking. It was the last time you could probably get a good deal in bourbon. I kind of point towards about 2012 is when everything starts going to shit in terms of pricing and allocation and hype bottles and whatnot. But previous to 2012, someone who kind of knew their stuff could find pretty much everything and drink pretty much everything.
I'm going to quantify that statement again.
Yeah.
It still was limited. There were still maybe only 25, 30 real players in the market, maybe not even that many, you know, that were in there. And yeah, you could get Pappy. Yeah, you could get Black Maple, Crown and Makers. And they were all having a hell of a run at it. I mean, Four Roses was like dabbling around.
Yeah.
Compared to today where, I don't know, what's the final count? Like 373 different distilleries or something like that making American whiskey. I forget the number, but it's pretty big. But 2012, like, that was the last opportunity, I would say, where you could get the stuff that's highly desirable now.
Yes.
Like ain't no thing. Like, all these dusties you're talking about, like, they were just sitting there. Those were people just drinking whiskey. You know, the common thread is like, oh, shit. Like, even I forget who we spoke to recently. Yeah, Zach from ZTB. He's like, yeah, dude, if I would have known some of those Willets we were opening and going to be worth $15,000, we probably wouldn't have opened them.
Yeah, there's lots of people like that who, you know, were buying literally every single Willet barrel they could get their hands on, drinking them. I mean, I remember being at my friend's house on, I think it was a holiday, maybe New Year's Eve, and we were just making Manhattans out of a 25-year-old Willet. I can't remember the number, but we weren't like acting like we were bawling out. It was just a very good whiskey, and you know, why not make some Manhattans with it? You know,
$179, right, at the gift shop. Somebody got it. It was like, it was the Johnny Walker Blue of American whiskey. Like,
yeah, it was, you know,
have fun with it.
Yeah, it's a nice thing to treat yourself to on New Year's Eve. Of course, you know, we probably drank $10,000 worth of Manhattans that night, and you can't put a price on memories, can you?
No. That's the cool shit we get to talk about. So keep going with the journey. So now we're in the aughts now, and whiskey's coming. Like, how does your introduction to, like, getting deeper into the rabbit hole go?
You know, by then I start going to Kentucky more often. You know, that's kind of when single barrels and private barrels start kind of exploding. If you want to get really nerdy into that stuff, doing your own barrel picks and whatnot, you know, craft whiskey finally starts getting decent after a decade of kind of being terrible. So you can start branching out, exploring things like, you know, 2014 is a year where I think a lot of brands come out, like Wilderness Trail, New Riff, stuff like that. And you're starting to say, wow, okay, there's some actually decent craft whiskey starting to hit the market finally after all these years of tiny barrel crap. Things started really opening up, and there was a lot to try. You know, I was drinking other spirits too. I mean,
are you a journalist at this point?
Yes, I am. Yeah,
you're front row to all of this.
Yeah, and when you're a journalist, everyone sends you every damn thing they make, whether it's good or bad. A lot of people think that's a great gift, but it's a blessing and a curse when the doorbell rings and there's boxes full of packing peanuts and then some absolutely terrible whatever.
It's the worst.
Come to my ass and get some.
Worst.
Yes.
Yeah.
I start exploring rum, agave spirits, brandies, you know. I'm really just drinking anything that tastes good is interesting by this point in time. I guess bourbon has always remained my first love. It's because of that, you know, palatable flavor you talk about, caramel and vanilla. It's always a good way to end the night or start the drinking session without really challenging your palate. It's a very exciting time for drinking. I kind of feel like perhaps we've hit the peak and things are starting to go back the other way, but who knows? I've been wrong.
But I think that's why your latest book is kind of on trend, because that's all I try to do now is go down the rabbit hole. Because I believe after spending enough time in distilleries, the integrity was always there. People made whiskey. They made whiskey. It was a job. You showed up to your job, and on Friday afternoon, they gave you like a pint of it to take home. But they didn't think anybody cared. They were just making it, and it was what it was. It went to liquor stores, went to restaurants, went all over the world. Great. But no one was like, oh, my God, like, that's different. This, you know, that's different. It's not until we're at this point right now, I would say the last 2-3 years, where obviously everything exploded, let's say the last 5 years, where you're like, I'm going to go revisit something that was made in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Whoa, that's different. Same company, making it now. Very different the way it used to taste.
You're absolutely right. I don't think people knew how good they had it back then. When you drink something as recent as, you know, a 1980s Wild Turkey 101, you're going, Jesus, this was like the, you know, $9 bottle that everyone got at the corner store every Friday. How is that possible? You know, the answer is because if, you know, Wild Turkey had this good of barrels then, it would go into Russell's Reserve or Master's Keep or something else. It wouldn't just go in a 101 bottle.
Well, they just had so much of it and nobody wants. I mean, I'm close to Marcy from Preservation. She's like, Japan.
Yeah.
They wanted it. That was it. We had all of our, we had our GIs over there and they wanted to be America. So we just shipped it all out there. Little did they know they were getting the Pappies. They were getting everything.
Well,
Wild Turkey's up the yin yang.
Yeah.
That was Japan.
Japan kind of taught us, you know, Marcy and Julian Van Winkle, that there were people on planet Earth that had a taste for, you know, ultra-aged bourbon. You know, most Kentucky good old boys thought, you know, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years, maybe 12 years as long as you could age bourbon. And the Japanese said, you know, we like well-aged scotch, so we like well-aged bourbon. And they said, fine, you can gladly have these, what we think are over-oaked bottles off our hands. Instead, they said, actually, these are incredible. Send us more. And, you know, eventually Americans figured out we'll take them back here too.
Well, I mean, and that wasn't realistically till what, like 2015, 2016, where all of a sudden you saw them kind of like sticking and growing, not like, hey, it's up and out of here. In reality, is less, you know, in the last 10 years, to think about in the lifespan, you know, Buffalo Trace was built in like, you know, 300 years ago or something yeah. crazy. And you're like, hey, that's not too bad considering in the last 10 years, we've seen the appreciation of what the older stock was.
Well, Blanton's is the funniest example. It's been on the market for, you know, what, nearly 40 years, and America really did not care about it until the last like 5 years when people just start going insane. I mean, there used to be a time very, very recently you could walk into any liquor store in America and buy a Blanton's and bring it over to someone's house as a housewarming gift. It was always there. It was reliable. It was in the funny little bottle, but you know, those days are gone. Oh,
the irony in that statement is like when I go out to friends and my wife's like, oh, bring a bottle of whiskey. Like, you know, and I'm like, they don't know what the fuck they're drinking. No disrespect. Yeah. Really nice. Love them. I bring Blanton's. You like, it's like a crowd favorite. I'm like, dude, I ordered that Costco for like $52. Like, you have no idea. I have multi-$1,000 bottles, but hey, that 52, that got you guys excited. Enjoy.
Yes, yeah, it looks like a giftable bottle.
100%. And it's beautiful, and they all can't get it because when they walk into the store, they say, allocation one per person. Oh, we don't have it. And you're like, what?
Yeah.
You should have, like, everyone's seen the video at Buffalo Trace, like how many they make every single day. Like, everybody should have multiple. There's enough to go around.
Yeah. So,
give me the awakening of the dusty journey. Like, what clicked?
You know, go back about 10 years ago, I was big into whiskey back then. I'd never even heard of vintage whiskey. Of course, I'd heard of vintage wine. I'd even heard of vintage beer back then. People were collecting lambics out of Belgium. But this one guy told me he's a dusty hunter. And I said, well, what's that? He said, I drive around Los Angeles. I go into liquor stores. You know, they have bulletproof glass. That's probably a good sign. They're going to have what I want. And I see if there are old bottles from the past. Sometimes still on shelves at the price they were put on the shelf at. And I said, well, why would you want to do that? And he explained to me, well, some of the greatest distilleries of all time don't even exist anymore. You know, Stitzel Weller, National Distillers, who used to make Old Grandad and Old Crow and some other things. And so to find these old bottles was to taste the past. Well, okay, well, why do you want to taste the past? I'm not sure if I knew back then that unlike wine, spirits don't change in the bottle. So you get an Old Grandad from National Distillers from the 60s. It tastes like, you know, what it would have tasted like when a person opened that bottle Friday in 1966. And this guy told me, you know, it the stuff from the past tastes better for whatever reason. By then, bars were starting to pop up that had vintage spirits collection. Canon in Seattle was probably the most famous at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Still has an incredible selection because 178 pages. They have to use an iPad. They have so many pages. Pretty much whatever year you want of any whiskey in the history of time, they have. It'll cost you a lot, but they have it. But I started going to places like that and, you know, the Milk Room in Chicago. And I started tasting whiskey from the past and going, damn, it really was better. Or at least these bottles were better. And that started intriguing me. You know, what was going on? Why were these better? And if you talk to modern distillers, especially modern distillers that had been around since the old days, you know, Jimmy Russell, they'd say, well, you know, we're making the best bourbon we've ever made in our lives. And to a certain extent, I think that is true. It's a more consistent product than ever before. All the bells and whistles of these distilleries, MIT microbiologists in the laboratory to assure that there's no fermentation errors or whatnot. You know, you never taste a bottle of bourbon that's screwed up these days. You might not love it, but you never go like something happened when this was being made because they have probably some of the best quality control in all of...
Well, you nailed it.
Yeah.
You nailed it. I was with Harlan at Buffalo Trace 2 years ago, you know, when he had just released the whatever 2 years ago BTAC, and we're drinking them in his office. And I said, you've been doing this 23 or 33. And Harlan, if you're listening, please don't get pissed that I didn't know if it was 23 or 30. You've been making whiskey a long time. I said, what's the difference? He's like, Gavin, the whiskey you're drinking right now is the cleanest it's ever been. We have so much technology to remove impurities, everything. It's like, as clean as it comes. And I'm like, man. So my analogy to him there was like, well, you know, you get a beautiful piece of meat and you cook it on a nonstick pan or you cook it in your seasoned griddle.
Yes.
it's the same piece of meat. It's very different. You're giving me nonstick pan now. And he's like, I guess so. Yeah, that's what I'm giving you. It's going to be, you know, there's nothing else. And I'm like, listen, I get that from a business perspective and all that kind of stuff. But I'm like, let's go drink some of the stuff from the seasoned griddle. And, you know, and he's like, no, I get that too.
Right. Yeah. You know, you have to ask yourself, was there some magic in that seasoned, you know, cast iron skillet? You know,
yeah.
Wild turkey used to ferment in, you know, cypress tanks. You got to think some sort of microflora or house signature got into the woods, into the side of the tanks. And was that some of the magic? Was the, you know, inability to clean the distillery to an inch of its life part of the magic? I talked about Belgian lambic makers earlier, the most famous one, Cantillon. They don't even let you take down a spider web in the corner of their brewery because they think something's inherent in all the dirt, all the dust, everything in the distillery, in the brewery that's been there for 100 years that makes their beer taste the way it does. So they don't want it clean. And if you're distilling or brewing something, anything dangerous is getting fermented out, is getting distilled out. So there's no worry in that. But you have to wonder if this perfectionism is creating flawlessly good stuff, but the disappearance of artistry and mistakes and whatnot is kind of making some of the highest levels of flavor and complexity and signature notes disappear.
And Aaron, I'm going to throw a big word out there. And I, okay. You know, this is no
disparagement. I hope I can pronounce it.
No. This, like, my concern is that all of the thingy-mabobs and nodules and computers,
yeah,
is taking the passion out.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Anyone who's gone to a giant Kentucky distillery, you know, if you couldn't smell the booze, and you just looked at all the people in hairnets behind computers and whatnot, you know, they could be making Doritos. I'm sure there are some passionate Doritos makers out there. No offense to the great Doritos makers of America. But, you know, it's a factory setting. It's, you know, it looks no different than Laverne and Shirley making their, you know, factory beer in Milwaukee. There are, of course, still very artisan makers of spirits across the world. But the bigger ones have definitely seemed to be a little more, you know, factory, passionless. You go, you know, some of these people look like they got a job here because it was the job closest to their home and they don't have a passion. Lots of people have jobs that they don't have a passion for. Good stuff.
I went to one place where I'm not going to name names, but it was two people sitting behind a computer. And I swear that they were probably playing crossword puzzles.
Yeah.
Because everything was computerized.
Yeah.
And they were just there in case like a button went off.
Yeah.
That meant like, oh shit, something went wrong.
Yeah. And then you,
that was their job.
And then you ask yourself, no matter what city you live in, you know, check your local events listing. Some master distiller from Kentucky is in town tonight doing a tasting. Well, a lot of these master distillers never seem to be at the distillery.
Because they're like top chefs now. You know, it's the right chef that does all the cooking. The top chef creates the menu and shows up for the PR event.
Yeah. Having said that, I do like a lot of modern bourbon.
You can do that now.
Yeah, you can do that now.
I'm excited about this new thing with the modern bourbon blending.
Yeah.
Because I think that there's enough unique ingredients to play around with it. But, you know, my heartstrings get pulled. Like, you know, you talk about canon. I'm good friends with Tommy at Ballard Cut. So I'll go to Tommy and he'll be like, what rabbit hole do you want to go down tonight? I'm like, let's do bourbon from the 1980s. Or let's do Japanese whiskey from the 90s. And he'll curate 10 bottles. For me, I do quarter ounce pours. So number one, it doesn't financially hurt me too much. But I really just want to try a lot and not be hammered and actually enjoy every moment.
Yeah.
It's just mind-blowing. Like, it was just different back then. Like, if you try Japanese, you try like the first Hibikis or the Yamazaki Pure Malts. Like, side by side between the first Yamazaki 18 Pure Malt and the current Yamazaki 18. I'm sure they're both 18 years old at least, of course. But they're definitely not the same whiskey.
Right. The first Pure Malts aren't even that old. They're from, you know, the late 80s. A lot has changed quickly.
So on your dusty journey, are there a couple of, like, standout moments, or are they all just super cool and fun? Because I honestly believe there's so many dusties. Like, I've done the pre-prohibition and the post-prohibition, And I like, I get blown away, like stuff that like, oh, this was like 1909, you know, bottled and bond for medicinal purposes only. And, you know, only 6 years old. And you're like, what the hell is this? This is delicious. Or this is funky as hell. And I think there might be an opening in the thing that just oxidized it.
Yeah. It is mind blowing how a lot of vintage bourbon is so flavorful at a young age and at a lower proof. You know, I really like Pre-Fire Heaven Hill. That's before 1996. You'll try some that are youthful and maybe 86 proof, and the complexity, the aroma, the texture and mouthfeel, you just cannot get that from 86 proof stuff today. And it really makes you question and wonder why.
Food, another food analogy from there is like, I feel like those young ones, it was almost like a sauce reduction. That's yeah. How they got so much flavor out of it. Like, they just didn't F with as much water.
They were going in the barrel at a lower entry proof.
Lower entry proof. Nobody wanted it. Hey, we'll be happy if you guys get us 300 cases. All right, cool. We don't need to cut it with the river next door. No, don't have to do any of that. Right. It's fine.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So I know we've just literally crushed 35 minutes. This is fucking awesome. And I think we have to do another call. And the question I really love geeking out on, as you've had this journey now for how many years you've been a journalist?
Probably, you know, I was getting bad paychecks as early as 2006.
Okay. So 18 years.
I guess so.
Are there one or two standout moments when you just wanted to like, kind of, if you were looking at a drone, very 2024 language, down on you, you'd be like, holy fuck, life's pretty good that I'm doing this. Are there any of those moments that stand out where you're like, whoa, pretty cool. Didn't see this one coming, you know, in my earlier life.
Not even doing with being a journalist. I was at a Christmas party, you know, last December, and it was a fine Christmas party. It was on a Sunday. It was about 10 p.m. I was ready to go home, and I'd met another guest, and he said, I just built a bar in my basement across the street. I want you to check it out. This was in the beautiful Carroll Gardens neighborhood of Brooklyn. I didn't really want to go. I wanted to get home. I have kids too. I got to get up early. But he said, you know, why don't you come over? It's a spectacular bar. So I went over, you know, okay, it was probably the best bar I'd ever seen in Brooklyn. He said, go into my liquor vault and pick us out something to drink. I go into his liquor vault and absolutely spectacular collection. I spy a Red Hook rye. I see some other stuff. I'm not going to go back in there and say, you know, I'd like to drink this. So I go back. I said, you know what? You have a lot of good stuff. Why don't you pick something out? And he said, I'm going to put together a tasting that I don't know if anyone's ever had in their life for you. And he came back. I must have sent him some dusty ESP. He came back with not one Red Hook rye, but Red Hook rye 1, 2, and 3. And they're at 11 p.m. on a Sunday in late December. Stranger's basement, we drank about, you know, $100,000 worth of legendary rye whiskey, and we agreed number 3 was the best. So, you know, that was not how I planned to left the house, but, you know, that's Brooklyn, and that's the vintage spirits community for you.
I mean, I've only been fortunate enough to have number 2, and that knocked, I mean, I was done. I was like, I could stop drinking today. I'm good. Like, that's it. I went to the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
And hearing their story at Linnell, like, I was like, whatever. Picking some whiskey, cool story.
Right?
Like, don't give a shit. Get it out. Hey, good luck.
Yeah, that was the New York I was talking about of the aughts where, you know, from what I understand, Linnell's closed in 2009 and there were still bottles on the shelf at $75.
I don't know. You know, I'm just like, as you are, just geeking out on all of this older vintage stuff, which started to pop to the surface. You know, thanks to Sotheby's, thanks to many people that we just, well, I guess, like, listen, I wasn't looking for it. Like, it was interesting. You know, I went to a tasting years ago, but it was actually for Christie's.
Yeah.
And Christie's in Beverly Hills, they had a client call them. The father had passed away. They had multiple homes in LA, and one of them was just for storing their cruise ship clothing. Like, that, the whole house was just for the entire family to throw all their cruise shit, they love doing cruise, all their clothing in there. And when the dad died, they were like, hey, we're going to put the house up for sale, so we're going to clear it out. So they went to clear it out, and they found this door in one of the closets. And as went back, and it was all this stuff from the early 1900s. And it turns out his father probably was throwing I mean, they were a hotel magnet family, that they were throwing, you know, prohibition parties back there like we see movies of. And, you know, you might see someone who remembers those days, but just tons and tons and tons of whiskey in all shapes and sizes. Obviously, back then, for medicinal purposes, there weren't many big bottles. You know, most of them were, you know, pints and half pints and quarter pints and stuff like that. And he was like, holy shit. I mean, they had a Bushmills back there from then. I was like, are you kidding me? Like, what the hell? And so we cracked all these open because they were obviously auctioning them. And I remember they got pretty decent numbers. And there was a couple that I wanted to buy, but like they were selling them by the crate. And I'm like, well, I don't want that many of them. Like, I just want one. And they're like, no, like we're being good luck. And it's like, now I think that was like 5 years ago. And now those bottles are like 10x because there's this resurgence of like Dusty Hunters. And people who are just like, yeah, I want to have something unique in a day where I don't have to play stupid allocation games. You know, if I'm not running a bar, what's my killer app? Like, I'm sure you've been to Bardstown Bourbon Company.
Yeah.
You know, you go in the back room there and that's all, you know, when I sit there with Brandon and Danny, like, you're drinking shit that's obviously not coming, may or may not ever have even been in a liquor truck because it's so old.
Yeah. I mean, the pandemic really, like, jacked up the dusty market as people sat home spending all day on the internet. I mean, I remember, you know, going back to Red Hook Rye, entering the pandemic, someone offered me a bottle for $10,000. And I thought, well, that's absolutely ridiculous. That is the absolute peak this bottle will ever be. If I'd bought it, you know, a year or two into the pandemic, I think one sold for $100,000. So
I got offered one yesterday for $60,000. And I said, well, why would I pay that when the last auction was only $60,000? And in my head, I'm like, there's no fucking way I'm paying more than $10,000. So like, I appreciate the communication and the chatting, but like, I'm not your customer for that bottle. I couldn't, you know, as much as I love my investing and all that kind of stuff, like I don't, you know, I think it's coming back to roost. The prices are starting to change. I think whoever's got what they got, they got. And now it's kind of like more like, hey, where can I go find it and drink it? Like when I was in Scotland, people like, holy shit, you know, you ordered a pour of that 1952 Macallan. Like, yeah, in America, that would be like $10,000.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like, where am I going to get that experience again?
Yeah, I mean, for the people like us that really have the passion, to know what these things taste like is a lot more valuable in many cases than just having an unopened bottle.
100%. I mean, like, for me, it's like just being able to kind of like I had no idea all the, you know, the older black maples and, you know, the red ones. And I was like, this is mind blowing whiskey.
Absolutely.
Mind blowing. And nobody cared. That was like every day or Japan. You know, like you said earlier, like the guy spending $9 on the corner on a Friday, he was going to get hammered. I mean, I should actually look. Maybe, you know, when did Glencairns actually even make it into the market?
That's a great question. They kind of feel like they've always been with us. I don't remember a time where I thought, what the hell is this weird glass?
Yeah. Or you asked to get a spirit that you were going to sniff and taste and sniff and taste and sniff and taste. It wasn't like that. I mean, you had cognac in those big snifters. Whiskey was normally, if you wanted with soda, with ice, with water, how do you want it? I mean, when you had pomp and ceremony, they brought it all to you, you know, on the silver tray. And they're like, here's your whiskey setup.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, hey, you know, so like this neat thing, you know, is a big deal, but it wasn't like that back in the day. Whiskey was meant to be drank and to get what whiskey did. You got drunk or you kind of like mind erased whatever the troubles of your life were. You sure as fuck didn't sit and sip it and be like, oh my God, is that? What stone fruit is that? Oh my God, no one's ever used that plum in this thing. You know, you're like, yeah, I don't know. That was good.
Yeah. Well, you know, and a lot of older people wouldn't have liked the Glencairn because they wanted to pour a ton of ice into it. And obviously that would not fit. I don't know. The Glencairn just appeared on the scene. Maybe I should write about it.
But I tell you, there's something there because it's like that. The Glencairn had to have changed the trajectory for the whiskey drinking experience.
Yeah, it kind of said, we are a serious bar and you are going to drink this seriously.
And we're charging you a serious price. Because I remember when I had like bars and restaurants, you couldn't, you know, Johnny Walker was like, blue was like $28 a pour. Because like piss water whiskey was like $7. You know, and you were like, fuck, like it's got to, you know, like, so now it's like, you know, you can go in and spend thousands of dollars in a bar just drinking whiskey without any food. You're kind of like, well, that bartender's pretty happy. What did that engagement take him? Like 4 seconds to pop it, pour it, and put it back? You know, as opposed to like, shake, shake, shake. Let me tell you. No, fuck it. You want to order it? Order it. Knock yourself out. And tip me for the 4 seconds.
The thing with the Glencairn is it's easier to eyeball a small pour as well if you're not jiggering. You know, you put a giant rocks glass out there. It's very hard to eyeball and free pour an ounce because you're just barely coating the bottom. So I'm guessing when whiskey was being served in rocks glasses, people were getting a lot more of it from bartenders who couldn't eyeball their pour as well as they could.
Oh, 100%. I mean, that was one of the biggest things. Like in my stuff, we had the stupid thing with the ball on it.
Yeah.
You kind of, because there was, you wanted to go real fast. The jigger just takes way too much time. You know, it's just like boom, boom. And then I remember like being at a Vegas bar show 10 years ago, and they were selling like a whole automated inventory system that the RFID was in the cap. So every pour was accounted for and you couldn't take the thing off. Like you had to get a manager's approval to like pop it off and put on another bottle. Like, wow, you've just taken the whole personality out of it.
That's some Salt Lake City shit.
Well, Eric, I'm so glad I could get you on. Do you want to tell everyone on your social media? Obviously the book, you know, just let's end it with you telling them how to follow you and learn more about you, man. And we've got to do this again.
Yeah, I would love to. Yeah. I'm Aaron Goldfarb on all social media. Instagram's really the only place I'm posting a lot these days. In the new book, Dusty Booze in Search of Vintage Spirits, it's available on Amazon. It's available everywhere. If you don't live in New York and want signed copies, I'm happy to send signed book plates to you free of charge. So hit me up on Instagram and tell me you want one and your address and I'll get those out to you. But I appreciate anyone who buys copies and I think you'll enjoy it.
You definitely will, everybody. Seriously, like you've got to start to learn more about the history of this great country and the great whiskey because it's something special. I'm not saying any shit about the current whiskey you're drinking. It's great too, but it's just different. That's it. Just different. Aaron, I appreciate you taking the time, kind sir. Look forward to meeting you in person. I'll message you some stuff. I'm in New York like every month now. Guys and girls, thank you for listening. I appreciate every single one of you. Make sure you rate the episodes. Keep listening. Tell friends. And I'll continue to find you amazing people that are just truly passionate about whiskey. I talk to you all soon, and that's a wrap.